Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that was the great Bill Miller. Welcome back to this conversation, and we're looking forward to having you be part of this conversation. There was an article in the New York Times, and we've talked about this a lot. You know, we all say these things. Does everything happen for a reason was the name of the article by two researchers who've been studying this on multi-levels. And we hear all the time when somebody says, they use in the article, someone, the story of a young man who was lost a leg in the Boston Marathon bombing. His name was James Costello, and he said after the bombing, and he was in hospital and being in rehab, and one of his nurses, Krista D'Agostino, they fell in love, and they got married. And he said, "I now realize that I was involved in the tragedy. It was to meet my best friend and the love of my life." And we say these things all the time, and it's not just in the religious world this takes place, because the studies found that religious people and atheists both think that things happen for a reason. And that other philosophers have always said about life that life is random. Things don't happen for a reason, that they're just there. The great existentialist philosophers like Sartre and Camus and others would say life has no meaning. It's what you put into it. So what is the reality for all of us? We have three really interesting people to wrestle with this question for us and with you. And really want you to join us with your thoughts, because you folks call in all the time saying, yes, it happened for a reason, and it was meant to be, and God has a plan for me, and we hear that. So I want to hear your thoughts about that at 410-319-8888. Write to us here, talk@steinershow.org. You can log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. Going from politics to his philosophical and religious side, the Reverend Dr. Todd Yeary joins us once again. He was here yesterday, senior pastor of the Douglas Memorial Community Church in Baltimore. Good to have you back.
Good to be back, my brother.
Dr. Joe Pettit's in the studio once again, associate professor and religion studies advisor at the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies here at Morgan State University, where we broadcast from. Joe, good to have you back in the studio.
It's great to be here.
And Dr. Nyasha Graham Simpson is with us, associate professor of psychology at Goucher College. Nyasha, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
And her students are here watching the show as well. So 410-319-8888 is the number here. So things happen for a reason. We hear that all the time. Just we hear that I am blessed because this is happening to me, and how this is happening. So, Todd, let me start with you. Why not? how do you read the article, right? And is trying to wrestle with what this means. What does it mean to you? Things happen for a reason.
I think from a faith perspective, a religious perspective, the question for us is not do things happen for a reason, but why do things happen? What is the larger meaning behind an experience or an action? Taken on its own, it is really somewhat isolated. But when you look at the potentiality in the moment, not just the experience of the moment, there are many layers of meaning that could be as part of this experience. We're sitting here, we're having a conversation. In and of itself, it's just a conversation. The meaning, the reason for the conversation can only be understood when you step outside of the event itself and start looking at where are the other points of impact. What's the effect on listeners? How do we now understand our positions on conversations as we are having the conversation? So why things happen for a reason is not a singular question. It is really a meaning question. Why is this happening, and how do I avoid limiting the power of this moment by not being open to the multiple levels of impact that it might have?
But the but in my mind, as you say that, is, and I'll come back to you with this. Nyasha, good to have you on the program for the first time. I'm glad to have you here. The but is, in my head, that most people, when they say this happened for a reason, look at it that there's some guide out there. Something there's a chain of events that made this happen. It wasn't just an accident.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the issue of meaning making is really important, and I agree that the question that we might ask as a psychologist, and that I would ask as a counseling psychologist, is not why did this happen, but or things happen for a reason, but why did this happen, and what meaning will I make of it? When we think about the meaning-making process from a cognitive perspective, we know that people hold global meanings, which we might call like worldview assumptions, religious ideologies and religious orientations are major global meanings that guide the ways that we interpret many events in our lives. And then we also have situational meaning-making mechanisms. And so when we're hit with a tragedy, when we're involved in a tragic experience, those two systems need to be renegotiated. And that happens, as the pastor said, when we step outside of ourselves. As a counseling psychologist or as a counselor, as a psychologist, we become most concerned when there is a disconnect or there's dissonance between your global meaning and the way you're making meaning of something situationally. So your question was, or the but to your question was, but there must have been a chain of events that led to this circumstance. That may be the way the individual is cognitively reappraising the situation in order to bring themselves back in alignment with their global meaning-making system. And psychologically, we would say that that's healthy and that's adaptive, and we would encourage that and support that and reinforce that.
Well, I think in many ways what happens, Joe Pettit, is that we look at this. Some people look at things that happen as God's will. It was meant to be. I have breast cancer because it was God's will that I have to go through this because I'm either going to a new place or I'm meant to learn something from this.
Sure, but we can think about God's will all sorts of ways. It is, traditionally speaking, God's will that we are to love in all situations. And so it's not surprising when good comes out of bad. It doesn't follow that the bad situation happened so that the good could come out of it. I mean, it's just not a biblical God who decides everything that happens. Sin and injustice would make no sense if everything happens in the world because God wants it to happen that way. The New York Times piece referred to karma. This is often misunderstood as well. Usually what people mean by karma is what the Buddhists would mean by the fruits of karma, the effects of choice. Karma is choice, and choice makes no sense in a world where everything is the consequence of past events. We're not choosing, we're just doing in that world. And so it is how you respond to what you have around you that determines the fruits of your karma. Your karma is your choice. God always expects you to follow God's will, but God does not expect you to do sin or to do injustice. God wants you to love your neighbor and to seek justice and walk humbly with God.
I mean, there's one quote in here. I'm going to read it just because it really hit me, and I was reading some more of this stuff, and often this guy challenges. I've interviewed him once, and I think he's as provocative as an atheist as some fundamentalists are in their view of the world. But let me read what Richard Dawkins says in this article anyway. They quote Richard Dawkins as saying, and when he talks about the universe, he said, exhibits precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. So the question is that existence? Is that really what we are? And we define it. But we want to have, or many people believe, that something else larger defines it, right?
I think it's a dynamic relationship. It is not exclusive on either end. We cannot fully comprehend how the sequence of events that leads to our presence here today actually took place. But as we raise the questions, we explore the clarifying of the meaning behind those questions. And so this notion of kind of this fatalistic indifference that we are responding to some abstract puppet master with no agency whatsoever is really a false interpretation of how we would understand the nature of human experience. Part of being human beings is the ability to interpret and to find meaning and understanding for what would ultimately become our story. In church, we call it our testimony. Our testimony is how we've come to interpret and articulate the depth of our experience, good, bad, or indifferent. And if there is, as Aristotle would say, the unmoved mover, the first cause that is implied in this process that gets it started, we have the opportunity to respond. And so Dawkins is true to, I think, the quandary of the atheist argument, is they make life random, and so the role and the opportunity to respond is really of no consequence because it is just some accumulation of random events that now culminate at a point in time. And time is not linear. Time is cyclical in some worldviews. And so what's happening now has a two-way interpretation, what happened before now, but what is going to happen after now, so that I don't live in a time isolation only concerned about present things.
So go ahead, Miyasha.
I was just going to say, and again, as a psychologist, I might ask a different set of questions. So of Dawkins, I'm less interested in debating the merits and the validity of his argument. I'm much more interested in understanding whether this represents his global meaning-making system, because that is going to influence then how he interprets and makes appraisals and reappraisals of events when he encounters them. So I'm less interested, again, in demonstrating the right and the wrong in your reason. I'm more interested in understanding your reasoning.
I, the philosopher, am very interested in Dawkins, whether he's right or wrong. I mean, his worldview is as fatalistic as some diehard religious folk, right? He thinks that we are just matter in motion and the laws of nature are pushing us in one direction, and it's not true randomness. But his argument, no scientist can look at the world and say there is no value in the world. There is no worth in the world. That's simply not a scientific conclusion.
Why do you say that?
Well, it seems to me that worth is always a question of two things. One, possibility, right? So Todd was talking earlier about looking forward to see how we're going to respond to a situation. That's only possible if we have different choices available to us. And the second thing you need is something that really measures the worth of those choices. There has to be a normative ground, if you will, for some people that's God, that views some choices as better than others. And if you don't have those two things, it's very hard to make value anything other than a sort of subjectivistic epiphenomenal froth on top of a deterministic reality. But there's nothing about science, and Dawkins just doesn't have it as a scientist, to say these things, these choices, this genuine freedom and this genuine value are gone from reality.
But in the studies that they were talking about, these three major studies that were done, that even atheists, whether they even in the less religious Britain or the more religious United States of America, that most people who are agnostic and atheists in these studies, I was trying to read through some of them last night. They're thick. I couldn't get through them all. But even they believe that life events have this underlying purpose, as the article said. Mm-hmm. And so that the question is that for you, does that exist, or is this something we layer onto it because we have to find a reason for things to have happened?
I'll jump in.
Yeah, jump in, right. And then we'll go to the phones and Chris and Clarence, your first two callers, Nyasha.
So, again, from what we know about our brains, which is very minimal.
It is extremely minimal. People don't realize how little we know about our
brains. We know very little about our brains. So really, I should say,
right,
what we think we know
is
that our reasoning, decision-making, logical abilities are all taking place in the frontal lobe, the most recent development brain structure-wise in humans. That the process that we're talking about with people who are religious is not different from the cognitive process that we're talking about with respect to people who are atheists. And I'm not really sure how they're defining religious and atheists.
It's very, right.
I don't know what religions even if you say Christianity, my reading and study of Christianity is that there are multiple Christianities. I don't even know what they're talking about there. But
you can be fundamentalist, you can be Howard Thurman.
Exactly. 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 And your meaning making approaches would probably be quite different.
Right.
But the cognitive processes we think are the same. And so the overlay of the cultural identity, the religious identity, the social identity, the political identity from a cognitive perspective would not really matter.
Yeah. So theologians love to argue. That's what we do. So we sit around seminary tables and we wrestle with these questions because they're the essential questions. I think what's here, and I'm wedged between Tillich and Whitehead and a few others in terms of, I'm a process guy. So I gotta think about this thing carefully. To the point of the gentleman who experienced the tragedy of the bombing, only to meet the love of his life, is every story needs a good ending. And if my story ends in tragedy, does it change how I understand the value of my story? So something in the midst of tragedy has to create the opportunity and the possibility for hope, which is not necessarily a religious thing. It's a human thing. Very often we interpret it in religious ways. Once I find that place to reattach to hope in spite of tragedy, it opens me up beyond the specificity of the event to the potentialities that lead to meeting the love of my life or finding a sense of renewed vigor to engage in the process. And so it's not so much whether you are religious or atheist. Those are questions about origins. Does
right.
God have an original place and space in the creative moment? But the bigger question is, what is our responsibility in the creative moment to respond in spite of the tragedy to create that context for renewing hope and opening up the possibility that we can have a good ending?
So if let's say there's a minister or a rabbi or a mom is telling the story about this man that we just talked about, right? And so is the conclusion that he lost his leg in a bombing because something had a plan for him to fall in love with this nurse at the end of this trials and tribulations? Or is the falling in love possible because of the trials and tribulations that happened and they just happened to happen?
The second one. Absolutely the second one. I mean,
but not everybody, some people would say, we know, brother, that you you had this terrible accident because God had a plan for you to meet this woman.
Maybe. I'm not sure that people are always as aware of what seems to be implied by what they're saying. Because things go well for some people, they don't go well for other people. And as the article pointed out, the flip side of the coin, that thinking that God has prepared something good for you, is that you also probably have to conclude that God has prepared something horrible for you if something horrible happens. Some people seem to be more favored than others. And I think that Todd's discussion of how we think about this and Naisha's discussion both speak to what we do with it. They're both forward-looking understandings of this, not backward-looking understandings of this. And the future is open. The future is not decided. The future is open.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking about, actually, first the point about hope and optimism. Something else that we think that we know based on the research in psychology is that individuals who have a disposition toward optimistic thinking and hopeful thinking do seem to engage in these what we perceive to be more adaptive meaning-making reappraisals in the face of tragedy. So again, within psychology, there's the idea that there's a cognitive process that goes on, and then there's also a dispositional personality trait that's intermingling with the environment and what's happening with the environment. But I think to your point of being forward-thinking, that's correct, and with respect to what we would do in the counseling session. But I think it's so I think there's more. There are so many pieces to, or there's so many ways that story could be told to a believer. So many lessons that a clergy member could try to impart. I don't think that the number of lessons gets reduced to two. That it's either the chain of events happened, God willed this for you, and this is why you're here, or God willed this for you so that you can do X, Y, and Z. That there could be a lesson about the inherent nature of suffering and what is a normative human process, that no one is immune. So I don't think that you necessarily have a situation where a person believes that they are either favored and I'm favored, so that must mean that there are people in life who are not favored, that I think some religious interpretations would say, no. I mean, there's scripture that talks about the man didn't do anything. You know, the good, the just falls on the righteous, the unrighteous. That's not an accurate reflection of the human experience. So that could be a part of it as well.
Let's take a very brief break. I'm going to come right back, and I'm going to let some of the listeners come in and have their conversations. I have some other thoughts as well. Chris, we'll come back to your call. We're going to break with Tchaikovsky's Overture from 1812, Opus 49, because on this day in 1893, he passed. We'll be right back.
Let's go. Keep on wearing those frills and flowers and buttons and bows, rings and things and buttons and bows. Don't bury me in this prairie, take me where the sea.
Dinah Shore, Buttons and Bows. It hit number one on the Billboard on this day in 1948. Our music has changed. We are wrestling with the question, does everything happen for a reason? Something that we all say, many of us think. It's a real deep question about. It's a deep question about who we are, what we are in the midst of, and why do things happen the way they happen to us. We're here with Dr. Joe Pettit, associate professor and religious studies advisor in the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies at Morgan State University. The Reverend Dr. Todd Geary, senior pastor at Douglas Memorial Community Church here in Baltimore, and Dr. Nyasha Grayman Simpson, who is an associate professor of psychology at Goucher College, and you at 410-319-8888. And Chris, welcome to the show. Chris, you with us?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, welcome.
Good morning to you and your entire panel.
Good morning.
I'm just an average guy who thinks about things that I'm probably not equipped to.
That's not
and
true.
So I'd like to, listening to this was interesting to me because at one point, a question kept bubbling in my head after going to a few Jesuit schools. And the question that came to me was, what if religion is man's way of dealing with his own existence? Mm-hmm. And so, in the end, no one can be wrong, you know, because there's ultimately going to be people who would say that their way is right and other people's way is wrong. So what if we find out in the end that no one is wrong? And so the question at the beginning about the statement that things happen for a reason, it just seems like it falls in that realm between religion, which is based on belief, and logic, which is based on intellect. And we as men is just an intelligent creature. We're such an intelligent creature. We feel like we have to be able to answer everything. Mm-hmm. So even in absence of an answer, we create one. Mm-hmm. Things happen for a reason. We don't know what the reason is, but that's the reason. And that's just, hearing your conversation is stimulating to me. I feel like I'm sitting in a classroom again, and I would like to engage you guys. But I know it's a show, so I won't hold up your lines. But it just seems like those kind of statements are just simply answer in absence of an answer. Mm.
I think that's a very powerful thought, Chris. I mean, I think that, and there's a lot of people, I think, who, Todd, who really do wrestle with this in terms of, I mean, every society has wrestled with these questions, which is why you find deep thinkers and spiritual leaders who find all paths, whether it's, you know, in polytheistic societies or theistic societies or animist societies or whatever they are. I mean, Zoroastrian, whoever, all kind of I think he's not may not be too far from wrong.
So running the risk of probably getting a whole lot of extra email that I don't need, I want to go back to the days when I taught world religions before moving here. So the notion of religion starts with an ultimate question, an unresolved seeking that causes us to find this answer. But in finding the answer, you mentioned the word mysterion. That as you discover, the more you discover, the more you realize you don't know. And so it opens up the door to doing more investigation, more inquiry, which then helps us to not only find meaning, but to expand meaning through the explorative process. Mm-hmm. Right. So the issue of which path do you follow is not are you on my path? But am I on the right path for me? There's always those two words that get left out of the conversation, and so it ends up being a debate as opposed to being a dialogue. And so my issue in the conversation is if you're a Buddhist, if you're a Muslim, if you follow the Jewish tradition, any of the Protestant traditions of Christianity, it's not are you on the right path? Are you the embodiment of the best that that path should have to offer to the collective conversation that allows us to shape a meaning together that we cannot shape by ourselves? And if we stay in our bubble, what we end up doing is we need more time with Niasha to help us kind of figure out what we've done wrong. And I think that's the source of illness, is we're not bold enough to be creative enough that I'm not trying to find the answer for everybody.
Right.
I'm really trying to find the answer for me.
And I would just say I don't want to minimize the grandness of what we're talking about, but to give another psychological perspective that even in quantitative methodology, when we're asking questions and seeking to answer them through a series of tests and statistical procedures, there is always an amount of variance that is unaccounted for. So even if I think I have all of the big factors that play into why this particular behavior takes place, I'm still going to be left with a variance that I cannot account for. There is an unknown. And so even within the realm of quantitative methodology, you know, you still have to be okay with the unknown. You cannot know it all. And that's really difficult for humans to do, I think.
And I think so in directly thinking before we go back to our next caller here, to Chris's question, Joe, I mean, that is where I think the basis of most religions come from, is trying to answer the unknown. And people do it in many ways. And that's why there's so many stories about creation in every religious path. I mean, and some conflict and some don't. But I think that, I mean, I think he's...
There are lots of unknowns in the world, right? Each one of us is something of an unknown to the other, right?
And to ourselves.
And to ourselves, right? We think that the unknown that we find in religion is a kind of unknown that is thought to underlie everything, to somehow give a direction or meaning to everything. And so it is different than the unknowns that we encounter in daily life. I would hesitate to say that they are merely a matter of belief. I'm still hoping that intellect has something to do with these conversations. And I do want to say, yay, Jesuits. I'm a Georgetown University grad, and the Jesuits are responsible for me being here in many ways. I do hope that intellect is still a relevant issue. I like this idea of conversing with each other. I tell my students sometimes that religious truth might be found more in the wrestling than in the answering. And I always appeal to the story of Jacob when I tell them this, Jacob whose name becomes Israel, and that one is being Israel when one wrestles. The trick is getting people to want to wrestle. In the story of Jacob, God does it for him by showing up and wrestling with Jacob. But a lot of people are not used to wrestling. Sometimes they think that wrestling is a sign of weakness. And
I think what you just said here, I'm going to go to the phones here just to throw this idea out as we go to Clarence, our next caller up, is that our inability or sometimes our inability and our desire not to wrestle with all kinds of questions in life, leads to the kind of simplistic answers in our life, like, this happened to me for a reason. This was planned for me to have happen because we don't want to wrestle with all the things externally and internally that created this moment. And they're complex. And I think that's part of what goes on with this. I mean, we're going to have these simple answers, and they don't.
One dimension that we haven't looked at is the vertigo that we can feel when we feel like we're exposed to events beyond our control. And so we want to get away from that by making the events in somebody's control.
Listeners, back to you. 410-319-8888. Clarence, you're on the air.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Steining, for
welcoming
your guest. First of all, I believe that creation and evolution are not mutually exclusive. Now, I believe that based upon my reading, which is far beyond the context of the Bible, that there was a time in the social space where there was no business, where the idea of God, which has been around a long time before religion, where everyone had access to that without a divine revelation. And the idea and the purpose was for the evolution of human consciousness, whatever that is. I've wrestled with this question. What is the evolution of human consciousness? Now, we've replaced that with religion, which in itself is a construct, which does not allow us to not view each other as in a mechanistic way. In other words, first of all, we don't look at each other as human beings occupying the same social space first. We look at each other as in those mechanistic terms first. Now, if we were to return to a time where everyone was looking and thinking that there was a creator of all, and the purpose of that was for that thing, the evolution of human consciousness, we would not be in the construct which religion has put us under, where my interaction and my occupation in this particular place on this sphere that we live on the outskirts on has an effect on Mr. Steiner, who is trying to occupy the same space. It sounds kind of woo-woo, Mr. Steiner, but I'm hoping you'll get to see where I'm going with that.
Yeah.
And thank you, Mr. Steiner.
Thank you always, Clarence.
Thank you.
Who'd like to respond first? Joe?
Very little about us has ever started out clearly. The human eye evolved from a light spot, a sunspot, where you could perceive, the critter could perceive differences in brightness, and that's about it. And we ended up with the eye as we have it today. I think sometimes we think of our knowledge of God as more analogous to sight like we have it today. I'm wondering if our knowledge of God has always been a little bit more along the lines of the eye spot, capable of sensing change, sensing presence, but in terms of its details, not so much. So I'm not sure I would understand what the caller was intending to describe when he said there was a time where we had more direct access to God and that somehow fell into the constructs of religion. I just can't think of a reason why that might be true.
Yeah, I think we define religion too narrowly based on the current cultural application. So if we take the word to investigate, to explore, examine facts, to determine meaning, what we would call truth, that truth then allows us to reframe our existence and maybe capture it in some ritualistic form based on that derived meaning. That's how religion becomes kind of codified in practice. But if you stop investigating, if you stop asking, why does this mean something to me, and we just go along blindly, then what you have is voluntary, pardon the pun, insanity, right? Because we're just doing it. We have nothing else better to do. It's the only thing we've always done. And so we're no longer engaging in the agency of creative exploration in the moment. So here we are, November the 6th, 2014, at a little after 12 noon. That's a factual assessment.
what the significance of the meaning. I think it's 11:15.
Yes. 11:15.
That clock is off.
Incorrect clock.
So factually, your clock is wrong, but the meaning is it's 12:15 somewhere. Now, how do I understand the significance of it, if there is any, if I'm not willing to investigate, ask questions, or explore? And so I think the hazard for religion is we don't empower anymore the inquisitive nature to ask the question why. And so do things happen for a reason is really, are we okay? Do we have permission to ask the why of a factual assessment and then dig deep enough until we find what is the truth of that answer for ourselves and be okay with it if nobody else likes it?
And I think that makes me – I'm going to go to the phone to you to Keisha, our next caller up. Just to throw the thought in here as you were saying that. You mentioned Tillich earlier. And I was thinking about, you know, Tillich – he says something about he puts doubt in every act and thought of faith. Mm. That's part of what you have to wrestle with. You know, and I think that – I like Paul Tillich as well. 410-319-8888.
You can't have hope if you don't have some doubt in there somewhere.
That's right. 410-319-8888. Keisha, you're on the air. Or is it Keisha?
Hi, good morning to you, Mr. Mark Stein.
Good morning, Keisha.
Good morning.
Hi, it's a very interesting discussion because I personally believe that everything is created for a purpose. You know, the universe, we're all connected, you know. The creator of all things, he had a reason for creating everything. Nothing was done without a purpose. So I basically believe with your question that you asked earlier, you said that things happen for a purpose, everything happens for a purpose. Yes, because we all have purpose, but regardless if we uniquely have a unique purpose, it still works together for the whole. So when anytime something happens, even though it may not be good, it may not be bad, it may be good, it may be bad, it's still for a purpose because we all have a purpose. We uniquely have a purpose. Each individual, each living thing has a purpose, so it works together. So that was my comment for the morning, and I hope you guys have a blessed day.
Thank you so much,
Keisha. And the question is, we have to think about that, what Russell, what Keisha was saying, what I asked her, was the purpose designed or is the purpose existence?
Look, if I have purposes, I either get to choose whether or not to pursue that purpose or not. Is my future open or is it closed? I think that God may have purposes for us and we create purposes, but if we choose the wrong purpose, right? I choose to try to express a religious and political conviction by planting a bomb at a marathon. That's a purpose that I chose. Was somebody put on a planet to do that? I don't think so. I think they chose and they did not choose well when they made that choice.
So let me take this in a larger context in terms of history and humankind. I'm thinking of there's four lines to a poem that Ho Chi Minh, who was the former president of Vietnam, who fought the Japanese, of course, and then fought the Americans in the Vietnam War. Ho Chi Minh was also a great poet. And he has these four lines that always stuck with me forever. I think about them all the time. And they are that one has to walk through the desolation and cold of winter before you can feel the beauty and warmth of spring. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's a very powerful small statement. So I think about that, and I had this intense discussion. It really wasn't an argument. It turned into one. Discussion when I was thinking about that things happen for a reason. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to somebody and I said, well, let's take slavery. Take the Holocaust. Let's take slavery. So slavery happened and brought millions of Africans to what has become known in the world as the Western Hemisphere. Mm-hmm. And millions died on the way over, there, and here. And so we say things happen for a purpose, for a reason. What would that purpose be? And what did it create? And did out of whatever that was created something that the African diaspora culture itself has recreated world culture and redefining world culture out of that pain. So is that a purpose? You know what I'm saying? So I mean, when you take in a broader social context, how do we play with that?
That's hard. As a woman of African descent, I want to be careful. I want to choose my words carefully. I think that there maybe a difference between that, between saying that everything that happens is good and everything that happens has purpose. And I think that when that scenario was presented, the resistance is that it becomes a slippery slope for people to be able to argue slavery was good. Look, people of African descent recreated world culture. Why are we hung up on this? And I think that that's a different statement from everything has purpose, and that in all that happens, there is purpose and meaning to be derived.
And if we're using the word purpose and meaning in the highest idealistic sense, then I think it puts us in a very dangerous situation not to have to consider, to Joe's point, that some things are not well-intentioned and they're purposeful. What they mean then depends on whether or not you leave the act, the event, the outcome as the final determinant, or do you find a space and a place from which to tap into that which we might call resilience, the rising from the ashes, so that then you can reclaim the creative space to then articulate a different purpose, a different outcome that reignites with hope and says, this was let's talk about slavery. It was intentional subjugation of human beings for a selfish purpose that was going to deny the full humanity of those who got caught in it. What we now understand it to be is, in spite of that intentional factual exercise, a truth came out of it, which is the resilience of generations of those who got caught up and now live to not only tell the story, but also tell the story from their point of view for what it means. That's where the difference is. It's who gets to define what the story is, but more importantly, who gets to assign what the story means. That's where we start talking about purpose and meaning. If you're telling me what my purpose is, if you're telling me what my meaning is, then what that means is we have a disparate relationship. You are the oppressor, I'm the oppressed, and it's a totally different frame of reference when we start talking about reason and meaning and symbolism and hope and all of those things that bring us to this point of conversation.
We can still speak of an underlying purpose if we want to. A former slave ship captain once wrote, "I once was lost, but now I'm found." He was off message, right? He was off of the purpose that undergirds reality of hope and of love, and he was pursuing purposes that were contrary to that. He was still pursuing purposes. He was still meaning-making. But in retrospect, he found those purposes to be done in blindness, to be those purposes to be pursued in ways that simply made him lost. So we can speak of many different purposes. And it is still quite possible to say the arc of history is long, but it bends towards justice, a line that King actually got from Thurman. So there are purposes that can be said to undergird reality, but we are free to pursue purposes that run contrary to that. And slavery was one of the most grotesque pursuits.
That is such a good point, right, that we can have antisocial purposes
right.
that undermine, you know, the greater good, the collective good, but it's still a purpose.
And you mentioned that I was thinking I have actually on my iPad, whatever the thing is called, I have 15 versions of that song, of that great gospel piece, the Amazing Grace. I think it is, and the story behind it is a show for another day.
The interesting irony is if you play the melody to Amazing Grace, written by a slave ship captain oppressing people of color, the melody of Amazing Grace is actually played on the black keys.
Whoa, I have never thought about that until this moment, Todd.
Teach.
There we go. Well, that's, I think, one way to kind of conclude this conversation, to know that we've wrestled with a subject that we don't necessarily come to a necessary conclusion about, but one that we have to continue to think about and wrestle with. So I want to thank the three of you so much for being here in the studio today.
Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
Good to be with you.
This is what we've called the Mark Steiner Show, our Philosopher's Roundtables, which we're doing more and more of on this program, because I think it's important for us all as a community to wrestle with many things. I want to thank Dr. Nyasha Grayman Simpson, Associate Professor of Psychology at Goucher College. First time she's been on the show, will not be the last.
Thank you.
To have you so much. Good to have you here. Brought some of her students with her to watch the goings on.
My counseling psychology students, Bianca Stern, Elizabeth Harvey, Giselle Rottenberg.
Glad you were all here.
You all get an A.
You all get an A today. And the Reverend Dr. Todd Yeary, who is Senior Pastor at Douglas Memorial Community Church here in Baltimore. Always good to have you on. Thank you so much. Good to be with you, my brother. Twice in 1 week. I love it. Dr. Joe Pettit, Associate Professor and Religious Studies Advisor and the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies at Morgan State University. Good to see you, Joe. Thank you for being here. Thank you all for calling in there. We'll take a short break, and we are going to break with, Hold What You Got, Joe Tex, recorded this song on this day in 1964. We'll be right back with Miss Ernestine and Crowd. Don't go away.
Just throw it away and you will see someone will have it before you can count. One, two, three. Yes, they will. Yes, they will. Listen, fellas, you know it's not all.